A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete.
Lose? I don't lose. I win. I win. I'm a lawyer. That's my job. That's what I do.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Comedians at Law podcast. This week we have our first pairing of Matt Ritter and Joan Weisblatt.
Good morning.
Morning, Joan.
How are you, Matt?
I'm good. The pressure is on for us to do very well as a combo. People really want to see us dominate.
Oh, my God. Wait, can I just go to the bathroom and I'll be right back?
You need to go to the bathroom right now?
No, just the pressure makes me have to pee, you know.
What if you held it in and then if it didn't go well, we could say it was because you held it in.
Yeah, okay, we'll try that, see how it works, and next time we may have a different game plan.
Yeah. I'm excited. We have a lot of things coming up on the calendar, which I'm pretty pumped about.
Yes, and we do too here on the East Coast.
Yeah, we're kind of, we're really becoming this bi-coastal behemoth.
Yes.
So I don't know if our listeners are aware, if we've made them aware enough, but we do have a very big show coming up this Thursday in San Francisco at Cobb's Comedy Club at 8 p.m. And you can get tickets online on the Cobb's website or on our site. Or, get this, I just made this up right now, but I can do whatever I want. I'm gonna give out two tickets on the podcast. What do you think about that, Joan?
Oh, what a great idea.
But should I give them to them now or should I make them listen in to the rest of the podcast?
I think we make those people listen.
Hey, you guys heard it. It was Joan's idea. So if you stay tuned later in the podcast, I'm going to tell you how to win two tickets to our show in San Fran. You don't even have to live in San Fran. You could give them to a friend who lives in San Fran. What's better than the gift of comedy, right?
Absolutely. Are we excluded from the contest?
Other members of Comedians at Law, you mean?
Yeah. Can we take them or I guess we should give them to our listeners.
I think it's probably best. You know, they'll think that things are not on the up and up if we start just distributing them amongst ourselves.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point.
Yeah, and right after that, right on the heels of that, you guys on the East Coast are prepare yourself for another big show from Comedians at Law.
Yes, on October 9th, which is a Wednesday night. At the Stress Factory in New Brunswick, New Jersey, a wonderful site, 90 Church Street, Comedians at Law will entertain to benefit New Brunswick Tomorrow, an excellent organization. Kevin Israel and Alex Barnett and I will be there. Dinner starts at 6 and the comedy show starts at 7:30. Please go to the New Brunswick Tomorrow website for your tickets. We're going to have a great time.
Very nice. I like that. We've got Cobb's and we've got Stress Factory. I mean, those are two of my favorite clubs in the country.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know anything really about Cobb's because I'm out here, but from everything you tell me, it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, next year when we do a show out here, we'll have to get you on the bill. It's a great club. It's really terrific. So I hope I know we're going to get a good turnout. We already have a bunch of law schools have confirmed and a bunch of lawyers, and it's going to be a good time.
Very good. Well, I have my San Francisco relatives on board, so hopefully they'll be out there and see you guys do your thing.
Yeah, they got to come to the green room afterwards, you know?
Hey.
And say hello.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. Should we jump into the news stories of the day?
Absolutely.
All right.
Since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
You know, I already hate Wall Street executives, Joan. I really do. I've never liked them. From personal experience, I've never liked the sort of lack. There's a certain lack of self-awareness with their speech. It's either lack of awareness or it's just I don't care what I say. I don't care if it offends. I live on a different planet rich person. and, you know, I'm entitled to do whatever I want. So this week we had a perfect example that the CEO of AIG, I don't know how you pronounce his last name. Do you know? Ben Moshe?
I think Ben Moshe, yes.
Ben Moshe. He defended something that I think is indefensible, which is Wall Street bonuses, you know, came under heavy criticism, and AIG took, you know, took a lot of flack, and I think rightfully so, because, you know, they're getting the biggest bonuses amidst a time where, you know, me and you and the American public had to bail them out. Literally, our tax dollars went to pay to save them and help restore our economy because they were, quote, too big to fail, which I don't believe in to begin with.
Yes, I agree with you.
And, you know, I think it's your job to not fail. And if you are doing everything wrong and you're in a position where you're jeopardizing the entire U.S. economy with your decisions, the bigger question is, why do you exist at all?
Right. I say to heck with you.
Yeah.
And worse, sometimes I say worse.
Yeah, yeah. No, don't say any worse now, but I hear you. I'm thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
And on this particular occasion, you know, in Wall Street, I think it was a Wall Street, a New York Times interviewer, and he defended against the criticism by basically saying that, you know, we're getting up in arms. This is a, you know, sort of a political play, and people are getting up in arms and with their pitchforks and this and that. And then he compared it to like what happened during Jim Crow.
How much more inflammatory can you get? How come he didn't mention anything about the Holocaust in here?
I think that was on the tip of his tongue, and the interviewer was probably like, settle down.
Right. I think you might be right.
You know, it's not, I mean, it's egregious on so many levels. First of all, you know, just saying something like that, you know, comparing your little situation to, you know, people getting lynched, you know, for their skin color, it's highly offensive just on its face. But it's, to me, it's even more offensive that he actually thinks this.
Well, it shows tremendous hubris.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't an accidental, I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but sometimes people say horrible things.
Yes.
And they don't mean them. But I mean, this is clearly how he feels.
Right. Well, you know, it makes me think about what happened this week as well, and not to go off our story here, but similarly, the president of Barilla Pasta made a remark about not wanting gay people to buy his pasta because they believe in family values. He tried to apologize. Here, I don't see any apology. I think that Ben Moshe firmly believes this and is unapologetic for what he said. This is his belief.
It's absolutely his belief. And this is the cycle, right? I mean, and listen, at least, right, you're right. At least the Barilla guy backtracked, but he only backtracked because he thinks he's going to lose money. I mean, let's be honest.
Yes.
But I think that's amazing too, because the reason that I say that I feel that this is how they feel, because this is consistent with every other CEO on Wall Street. Jamie Dimon, who is, you know, the king of Wall Street, JP Morgan, he constantly harps on the fact that every time we try to say, hey, you know, why do these guys make $50 million a year each? Why do they make $50 million a year when they're losing us money? And his argument is always, well, you need to be competitive for the talent. And my argument to you, Jamie Dimon, is, are you sure we can't find anyone straight off the streets to help destroy the economy?
Absolutely. Why do we have to pay people like this to do it? It's ridiculous.
I don't think you have to pay people to help destroy the economy. And then when it's finally turning around, it's not turning around for the rest of us. It's just turning around for them. Their bank accounts are back where they were 5 years ago.
That's right.
There are no jobs.
And they have us to thank for that.
Yeah. There are no jobs. And it's just the amazing hubris to compare people wanting you to not have, you know, $10, $20, $30 million bonuses to, you know, Jim Crow era lynchings. I don't want to say that he should have a Jim Crow era lynching just to know what that feels like, but maybe he needs a little bit of a reality check.
I agree. Matt, are you all right? I worry for your blood pressure.
Are you all right?
Okay. Yes, I know that. Take a pill.
Yeah, I need to take some Bayer when I read about this stuff.
Yes, I know. Well, you know, you have some firsthand knowledge of this, having been in the corporate world. Yeah, I find it very, very distressing. And later for Mr. Ben Moshe.
Yeah. Let's hope he gets fired. Let's move on to the next. Why don't you set up the next story for us? I think we're getting a little lighter as we go on.
Yes, I'll be happy to do this. This story was near and dear to my heart. This has to do with a will contest of Huguette Clark, a woman, a multimillionaire who lived her last years until the age of 104 in Beth Israel Hospital, playing with her doll collection, and there was a will contest. Now, the first thing that I love about this story is that she had mansions all over the world, and she spent the last years of her life in the hospital playing with her doll collection. This is a woman after my own heart. I spent years in my bed playing with my doll collection as I was growing up, having my mother wait on me. And this is exactly what I want when I die.
You wanna just sit alone in your room with your dolls?
Well, not even alone. I want people to serve me and to take care of me and to clean me and I want to play with my dolls. Yes.
Hey, listen, to each his own. I want to live inside of a harem, play with my dolls. You know what I mean?
And somebody else's dolls as well.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah, but you know what I love about this? Before we get into the story, I love these situations where somebody comes in, you know, some caretaker, and they always somehow end up in the will. Like, at this point in time, if you're a family member, how do you not see this coming from a mile away?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have an aunt who actually did that. She used to. I have an aunt who used to take care of people. Are you there? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have an aunt who used to take care of people. She would come in at the last minute and come in and tell them how much she loved them and take care of them for about 2 weeks, just in time for them to change their wills. And then, of course, there was always a blow up between her and the family. It was quite funny.
I mean, it's amazing. It's an amazing move. I think I'm going to start walking around hospices and just be like, remember me? I've been taking care of you for the past 2 years.
Well, you may have to knock down some people who are ahead of you trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, but also on the flip side, how horrendous of a relative do you have to be to like have this happen?
Well, that's a very good point. So in the story, this just really kills me. So, I mean, the fact that this person came in afterwards, this caretaker, who claimed that she was entitled to the doll collection, but she got absolutely nothing. But I just think it's amazing when the super rich have things to give away that are so astounding. Miss, you know, it didn't say anything about her ever having been married. I think she probably was a spinster.
Yeah, it said she got her money from her father, who's a copper magnate.
Right, exactly. Miss Clark, in her original will, aired. She had a Claude Monet water lilies painting, which she was willing to give to the Corcoran Gallery in Washington, D.C. for 50. She was willing to give them a 50% discount.
That cracks me up.
50% off? Would you want it? I'll give it to you for 50% off.
I picture her holding it out of her trench coat. I got Monet, I got Manet, I got Degas.
That's right, absolutely. That's right, like the watches up her arm. Instead, it would be the paintings in her trench coat. I love it.
I got water lilies, I got apples, I got pears. I don't even know what this fruit is, but it's standing still.
Well, in a classy way, she was also willing to give them a $10 million gift, which is, you know, quite lovely. But
it's confused. The $10 million gift and the 50% discount are kind of confusing in tandem.
They are, which makes for great comedy, I have to say, which is, you know, really great stuff. So it turns out, interestingly, and I wonder about this, that, well, not only did the caretaker get nothing, but Clark's attorney got nothing. Why?
Well, he probably had his hand in her pockets while she was dying, I'm guessing.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was.
I'm guessing she probably wasn't as stupid as they all thought. You know, I think the whole time, You know, because she gave her what ended up happening was this woman she gave her nothing, right? The doll collection. The woman, the person who nursed her for decades.
Yes, she gave her. She willed her doll collection, but that was under the settlement. She doesn't get it.
Yeah, which is interesting. You know, what's funny about that is, first of all, she nursed her. Your aunt came in there for 2 weeks. This woman came in for decades.
Yes.
She mistimed this whole operation.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's funny. This doll collection is valuable. But if she's been playing with these dolls all these years, the way I played with my dolls, I don't think that they would be worth very much. I used to take my Barbie dolls and pierce their ears with pins.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming over those last few years, every time she saw one of her dolls, she probably thought it was her soup or something and tried to drink
That's
it.
That's possible. Or maybe she had them all in plastic to preserve them so that they remained valuable and still played with them. I don't know. But
yeah, you know what I liked? I don't know if you ever saw that Twilight Zone episode where the guy made everybody put on those masks for his will.
No, I can't remember that.
Uh-uh. Oh, yeah. And then they stuck their real faces on. It was like he ruined their lives. He tricked them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yep. That's what I would like to see happen here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, her estate is worth $300 million. So I'm sure in the end, everybody will be happy and get what they want. And, then they can go to Wall Street and feel like they've been lynched.
I think she should have just given all the money to the dolls.
Oh, that's an idea.
I mean, if somebody could give them to cats, why can't they just give them to inanimate objects?
Oh, I know. You remember Leona Helmsley and her, I think it was her dogs.
Yeah.
She gave... Right, she disinherited her grandchild. I remember this so well. She disinherited one of her grandchildren, and in the will she wrote, "And you know why."
Yeah.
Whatever.
You got to be a real piece of scum as a grandchild to have somebody say that to you in their will.
That's right, and you know why.
Actually, it could have been something small, right? It could have been like you spilled that orange juice during dinner one time and you messed everything up.
Right. That's right. Or you forgot to flush the toilet.
Yeah, I could see my grandma cutting me out of the will for forgetting to flush a toilet once when I was like 16. She's a tough old broad.
Yes.
Anyway, should we move on to the final story?
Okay, that sounds like a plan.
So this one, you know, law students are in a bad place in 2013. There's not enough jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They were stupid for going to law school in the first place.
Yes.
You know, they should be working on, you know, becoming head barista or something more useful. And apparently there is a student who was really feeling his oats, as they say. And he was lucky enough to get more than one offer from firms. And instead of just keeping it to himself, like his fellow students think he should, he didn't just boast about it. He posted all of them on Facebook.
Yes, he's a DB, if you can figure out what that is.
Right.
Yes.
And so after he did this, you can actually see the offer letters, which is kind of cool. If you look really closely, you can see the name of the firms. One of them is Lisco and Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that. I don't know where the other one is. Somebody named Mr. Truth started posting them and protesting. And mm-hmm. calling him kind of saying bad things about him and saying, "It's emotionally difficult for me to see pictures like this when I have not gotten many interviews at OCI. He's basically saying, I don't deserve to be subjected to a shameless show of exhibitionism."
Yes. Well, I understand that there's a fatwa on this person's head now, so I don't know if he'll be around for too much.
Yeah, he's probably in physical danger.
Yes, I would think so.
Would you ever do something like this?
Oh, yes, that's very much within my personality. Would you?
Yes.
Oh. Well, therein lies the difference between you and me.
Yeah, well, I like getting under people's skin. I mean, that's something that I enjoy as a pastime.
Yes, yes. Well, I can see that helped you very much in your legal career, which is why we're in Comedians at Law.
Yes, 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 on yes, podcast yes.
On this beautiful Sunday morning.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, in this day and age, everybody knows everybody's business anyway.
Yes.
There are no secrets. I don't really see what the big deal is. He posted it. He's happy. I don't know. I live in Hollywood and, you know, I work in entertainment. And we have people posting every time they get hired on something and every time they sell a show, you know, and people feel similarly to where this guy did. They feel, you know, that I don't even have a job and this person's posting about how much success he had. You know, I don't know that they're necessarily doing it as an in-your-face. You know, truth be told, I think maybe this guy was just happy.
Well, you know what? I disagree with you because I think that there are ways to do it where you don't offend other people. You can say that you feel very happy or you're blessed or you feel tremendous gratitude or but just to stick it out there like that shows that you're a, you know, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the posting of the actual letters is a little bit, it's a little far. You're right.
It's a little braggadocio there that that didn't have to be.
But would it be okay if he had just posted on Facebook, got offers from X firm and Y firm, so happy?
Yes, I wouldn't have had any problem with that. That's not a problem. It's just the way that he did it. It was very in your face.
I just think everybody's a whining baby these days.
A whining baby?
Yeah, everybody who's complaining about it is a whining baby. Work harder and get a job yourself.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think that's a little bit much. I think of myself as more a sympathetic person than that, Matt. I am very disappointed in you, actually, that you would even say such a thing.
I have no sympathy for the weak.
Well.
Crush them like ants.
Okay, well, you know what? When your time comes and you're in need, see how many people come to your rescue. You probably,
you know who's going
to
come to my rescue? Whoever wants my doll collection.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think your mommy will be there, but I think you may be alone otherwise.
Yeah, that's all right. As long as somebody can feed me, that's all that matters. I want to gain like 300 pounds. You know, people usually lose weight at the end. I want to gain a couple hundred.
Yeah, I want to start smoking again, actually. That would be a wonderful thing.
Yeah, why not? Why not?
Smoke.
So I think that wraps up our stories for the week.
Yes.
Shall we move on to the Twitter sphere, and do a little segment we like to call Good Cop, Bad Cop?
Yes.
And I thought, wow, I got to go even bigger than that since we're doing Bad Cop, Bad Cop.
What? No, I said Good Cop, Bad Cop. I'm the bad cop, you're the good cop.
Okay, then there it is. That's it. I thought you said Bad Cop, Bad Cop.
Who's the good cop?
I think I will be the good cop. How's that?
Yeah, do you have Twitter open?
If you give me one moment, I will.
Yeah, because, you know, if you want to be the good cop, then you have to be nice to all the people that are our new followers.
Okay, so I'm almost there.
You know, we do have a lot. We had a good week. This is not the best week for me to be bad cop because we have a lot of positives happening here.
Okay, it's coming up.
We had a lot of good things. I mean, I still think people aren't using the hashtag. I'll just, you know, get on a mini rant. The hashtag CALPod is the most important thing for us. That shows you care and that you're listening.
Yes.
The rest of it is just nonsense as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, just follow our instructions so we don't have to chide you like little children who don't get offers at firms.
Yes. Well, I think that we had some people say some nice things about us this week, didn't you?
Yeah, we had a very, very, this is one of our best weeks.
Yes, I think so. I think so.
So I guess last week was starting on the 27th.
Yep.
So it looks like we had quite a few interactions. Why don't you give a shout out to our interactors?
Yes. You know what? I am a little bit lost here, which is not unusual for me. Where are you looking, Matt?
The connect button. The connect button.
Oh. Okay. I have to admit, I haven't done this before.
No, you haven't played good cop. She hasn't given a shout out to our new Twitter followers.
I haven't even played bad cop, let alone good cop.
Yeah, bad cop's more fun. You get to yell at people.
Oh, well, why don't you start yelling first and I'll chime in.
Well, there's not a lot of people to yell at. Everybody was really friendly and nice. It's very difficult.
I'm sure that there are awful things about them. You know, they're just showing you one side of themselves. I'm sure they're not all that wonderful.
I'm sure they're all terrible people, everybody who follows us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, this is so funny. Somebody just said, have you done a podcast about revenge porn yet? That could be fun. Do you know that this week, actually today, that's exactly what I wrote about.
Yeah.
Comedians at Law blog post.
Yeah, I can see that. Ruth Carter, she's very into the revenge porn.
Yes, revenge porn.
She's going to enjoy your article.
I think the problem is that she, well, I don't know. Maybe she hadn't seen it yet. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Ah, oh, yeah, and Ruth Carter said she's been catching up on our recent episodes, and we are so lucky. We have wonderful fans.
Yeah, we do. She's actually the only one who used the hashtag CALpod.
Yes.
So I think that entitles her to a free T-shirt. So Ruth, if you you know want to email us your address, we'll send you a free T-shirt.
And her bra size.
Oh, is that important for the T-shirts? I don't know how girls' bodies work.
Yeah, I don't know. No, bra size probably isn't important, but, you know, from small to extra large. But She just looked like a rather petite woman.
It's always nice to have your bra size. I mean, we don't need it, but...
No, but, you know, sometimes that's a piece of information.
So why don't you give a shout-out to some of the people who tweeted at us and...
Yeah, okay. So, let's see. Allison Monahan, are you in the Bay Area?
Yeah, she's gonna come to the show. We had her on the podcast, Girls Guide to Law School, which is a great site.
And she's going to be there, which is terrific. Good. Good. Let's see. Who else? Ah, Darren Patterson. Comedians at Law is sweet. That's great. Yes. Who else should we shout out to? Mr. Bernard?
Where are you going? You're going down. You're going down too far. I'm looking at go up the dates, the date this week.
The Bar Association of San Francisco. Oh, I see now. Brittany? Huh? Okay.
Who else we got? Who else?
We have Chloe Hickson. Chloe Hickson, who retweeted us.
Very nice. Thanks, yes, Chloe.
Yes, thank you, Chloe. And do you see any others?
I see Harris Legal Group favorited our tweet. You know, forwarded, told people to watch our video that we shot, our fake law firm ad. So that was really nice.
Yes, and NorCal Comedy.
Yeah, they're retweeting about the show, which is great. We got La Lawyer is new. DoubleTree LA is new.
Following us, yes, very, very good.
I see Oregon Women Lawyers also.
Mm-hmm.
UM Cary Law School and Elise are following us now.
Yes, and even Cop Comedy is happy that we're going to be there.
That's nice. That is very nice.
Yes, Brittany.
Oh, the Bar Association of San Fran even tweeted about our show.
Yes.
So I want to announce right now, while we have our Twitter followers listening and engaged, we are going to be giving out two tickets to our show in San Fran to the first person that tweets at the hashtag CALpod and says, I want those tickets.
That's going to be such a great show.
I want those tickets. That's what you have to tweet us.
Yes.
This podcast is going up on Monday. So, you know, first come, first serve, two tickets to whoever says, I want those tickets. And you will have two free tickets to our show in San Francisco.
Wow, that's wonderful. It's almost as good as winning the lottery.
Some would say better.
Some would say.
Yeah. And now I'm going to do an amazing interview with one of the plaintiffs at that Fox intern suit, which I'm excited about.
Oh, I'm excited to hear it too.
Yeah, I think we did great this week, Joan.
I did too, Matt. I really enjoyed working with you, and let's do it again.
Yeah. I feel the same way.
Good.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Comedians at Law podcast. We have a very special guest today. We're really excited to have him because we were just sort of talking about this issue in the news, and then I saw his name pop up on my Twitter feed, actually. We are joined by a current Georgetown law student, Eric Glott, but more importantly, he is the centerpiece of a hot-button issue in the law right now, which is the unpaid internship dispute. He was a former intern on the Black Swan. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the case. They sued Fox Searchlight and they won, and I think it's being appealed right now. Not sure the process, the stage that they're in, but welcome to the podcast, Eric Glott.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So why don't we just jump right in? Let us know what is going on with the case right now. Is it settled? Did they appeal? Where are we with the
Yeah, so what's happened is very recently, I think maybe 2 weeks ago, Judge Pauly, who ruled in our favor in the lawsuit, certified a question to the Second Circuit. So, you know, Fox filed for interlocutory appeal, and the judge has now certified the question of whether I and my co-plaintiff really were employees who were due wages, and that's going to go to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit already has a similar interlocutory for it, and now the question will be, after we file all the motions in support of our position, whether the Second Circuit wants to take it up. Otherwise, the case is still going forward as a class action.
Yeah, you know, I'm really excited on a personal level because I'm just extremely against what I see as a very abusive practice. I live in LA and I work in entertainment. Just a very abusive practice, especially in entertainment, of just really expanding the definition of, you know, what an internship really is. And I just wanted to quickly, you know, give our audience sort of the there's this 6-point test, right? I mean, that's
right.
And that was what, from, you know, a 1940s case.
Yep, 1947. You know, the Fair Labor Standards Act that established a national minimum wage was not even 10 years old yet.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court heard this case, Walling v. Portland Terminal Company, and it was about a 1-week, 8-day training program with these brakemen being trained. They weren't helping the train yard run, right? Today's internship is all about giving people as much hands-on, real experience as possible, but In this Supreme Court case, it was off on the sides. It wasn't helping the train yard run. It was draining their resources. They had to, you know, provide personnel to oversee it and equipment, and, you know, and it was only a week long. And they presented this question to the court: with this new minimum wage law, do you really expect us to pay wages to people who are basically a drain on us? We're trying to do some good by increasing the total size of the labor pool and teaching people job skills, and we have to pay them wages? And the court said, you know what? If you meet these really strict criteria, it doesn't make sense. It makes sense.
Right. And I guess, you know, in terms of the 6 criteria, I'll just go over them real quickly. And I
sure.
think if you fail one of them, right, I mean, you just have to be failing one of them for it to not be considered a valid internship, right?
That's the way I read it.
Right.
And that's the way Judge Pauly read it.
And you know, I think some of them are not so problematic, and I think some are. And I wanted to just talk about that with you. When I look at them, the first one is that the internship, even though it includes actual operations and facilities of the employer, is similar to training which would be given in an educational environment. I think a lot of internships might pass that test.
Well, I don't know. I mean, people, if you look at the Department of Labor fact sheet number 71 that came out in April 2010, you know, it kind of elaborated on the DOL's position on this.
Yeah.
And it says, you know, like a guideline would be, is it in a classroom? Does it look like an actual class being delivered, training being delivered, or does it look like work?
But some of them are, you know, some of them are hybrid.
Some of them might be, yeah.
You know, some of them are hybrid. And then the next one, you know, I think is a one that's sort of the lowest bar to pass. The internship experience is for benefit of the intern. I think, you know, on some levels, I want to get to the ones that really trouble me. On some levels, you know, there are a lot of benefits to be derived for the intern, but it doesn't say, you know, exclusively to the benefit of the intern or whatever. It's a little gray area. This next one.
And well, the other thing about that question, that point is, it's like, what job performance isn't for the benefit? I mean, the employee always gets something out of a job.
Right, which
it's,
is why
it's sort of vague.
That, yeah, that's sort of the lowest bar to set. And then, yeah. Then the next ones really start to bother me. The next one, the third one, is the intern does not displace regular employees, but works under close supervision of the existing staff, which is sort of a weird two-parter, because the first part, I think, is where a big abuse has already come into play in a lot of industries.
Right. Yeah, and I see the second part as really an elaboration of the first. The second part is basically, it's like a good way to tell that it's not displacing somebody. Is the person who's providing the training, so it's the person who would normally be doing that job.
Right.
You know, for example, somebody who works at the company shows you how to do something. So at that point, you're shadowing and watching.
Right.
And then the only time you actually do hands-on work is when the person who otherwise would be doing it is instead supervising you.
So you see it as sort of like, okay, so there's an apprentice next to you. That's how you know it's an internship.
Right. But whereas if you actually train them up and you show them how to do something and then said, okay, now here's your stack of work to do –
Right.
And they're off doing it. Well, that's actually something an employee should be doing.
But, you know, but I think I agree with you. But number four, I think, is the one where pretty much, you know, I don't know, 90% of so-called internship trainings are failing hugely on this one. The employer that provides training derives no immediate advantage from the activities of the intern, and on occasion its operations may actually be impeded. I mean, I think it's clear as day that almost all internships now, they are getting a huge, huge advantage from the activities of the intern.
Absolutely. And that goes right to the Supreme Court, the 47 case in Walling, which is that employer was deriving no benefit and was actually having its operations impeded by running a training program. And the court said, you know what, in those limited circumstances, and, you know, we don't want to discourage employers from doing that. That's a great thing. You're gonna take a hit on behalf of training up labor, go ahead and do it. We don't want to impede that.
Yeah. I mean, and now we're in a situation where...
Oh, you know, it doesn't look like that at all.
Yeah, entire industries are basically saying, you know, they have all the leverage because the economy's in the toilet.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and people of all ages even. I mean, you know, you're talking about grown-ups who have worked before. You know, maybe they're in a career shift, you know, or whatever, you know.
That's what I was doing.
Or in the entertainment industry where it's project by project based.
Right.
You know,
oh, yeah. And it's terrible for freelancers who are also always scrambling for the next gig.
Yeah.
Because employers can always dangle that in front of you. Ah, we'll get an intern to do it instead.
Yeah.
And they can push down wages because of that threat. I mean, it's really pernicious.
Yeah. And the rationalization is, hey, you know, we're under a budget and, you know, we're giving them a chance to break in, which I hate that.
Well, and that's the part about this that's really insidious to me is people now who defend it actually, like, they look at that fourth point and use a logic that's in complete odds with that point to defend what's great about an unpaid internship. They will use the logic of how much it is like real work as a justification for the value of having that person there.
I don't understand that.
Well, they'll use a logic and say, oh, this person didn't just watch us work. This person got real skills. They went and did something that was valuable and contributed to the project. So therefore, it's a real job skill they can now put on their resume.
Right, but that doesn't change the fact that the law says that if the employer derives an advantage, then it's not an internship.
But it doesn't change the fact that the employer is using that to control their budget, to save money, and to get work out of that training.
Yeah, I mean, it's just clearly one of the most abusive work practices that's going on. I mean, the other two, I don't know how you feel about the number five is the intern is not necessarily entitled to a job at the conclusion of the internship. I'm not really sure what, you know, the bright line rule would be there. Because
well, yeah, and I think that one's really there to prevent it from being an employer saying, well, the first 30 days you'll be unpaid, it'll be your job trial period, and then we'll consider paying you afterwards.
Right. Okay, yeah, so I guess that makes sense. And then the sixth one is the employer and the intern understand that the intern is not entitled to wages for the time spent. That kind of seems circular to me.
Yeah, I think that's there just to protect against the idea that somebody accepts it thinking it's a job and then finds out, oh, no, we're actually categorizing this as something else.
I mean, I think it's really, you know, for me, the two of them that really bother me is the one that the no benefit and the one that it's sort of like the educational environment, you know.
Right.
And actually the displacing of regular employees because in entertainment, I mean, it really does displace regular employees.
Well, and that's exactly, you know, I was encountering the problem before I'd ever heard of the Walling ruling and ever heard of the 6-point trainee test. And it bothered me to no end that employers were constantly looking for skilled labor and experienced labor and not wanting to pay for it. It was so clear that what they were doing was trying to control their budgets through that process. I just didn't know exactly what the law was.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I think sometimes in a weird way, common sense will lead you to a legal finding, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
No, exactly. So when I did read the fact sheet 71, when I finally read it, it was, you know, like the coin dropped. I understood it immediately. This is exactly the problem I've been facing.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, back then they really understood two things that I think are starting to get a little bit forgotten, you know, that unions played a valuable role.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we're looking at a body of law that came out of a response to the Great Depression and an employment crisis that we haven't seen since then until recently.
Mm-hmm.
And we are still mired in an employment crisis that we haven't seen, a scale of which we have not seen since then. And, you know, what's really, you know, unfortunately, I think we may have to suffer a little bit more before more people start rising up and demanding more collective action. Because what we've seen is the stock market and on the employer side, a recovery from the recession.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's been a jobless recovery.
No, I agree. I don't believe it's a recovery at all. It's only a recovery if people are working, to me.
It's
in my mind.
Right, exactly. It's a financialization.
Yeah, I mean it's great that the top 1% have all of their art back, but
right.
The rest of us need work.
Yep. And I guess there was something in the news a week or two ago. The top 1% have now captured, or the top 10% now have captured 50% of the income for the first time since the 1920s.
It's amazing. You know, but I think your case sort of hits the nail on the head of like right and wrong.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting. When we first filed, I would say half of the coverage was derisive. You know, Anderson Cooper went on his show and did a sort of comedy-ish bit called The Ridiculist. Perez Hilton poked fun at us, which was funny because a lot of the people reading Perez Hilton spoke up in our defense.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking to me. I didn't know that. That really surprises me.
But yeah, but you know what? The more now that there's more suits have been filed, we've had the ruling in our favor, people have been sort of required to think about it harder. More and more people get it. They understand that this is a problem and that until we actually provide jobs, I mean, these are jobs that employers need doing. And we're in the middle of an employment crisis that particularly hits young working adults.
Especially unemployment rates are skyrocketing for recent college grads.
Double digits. It's still in the double digits. It's twice the national average, while we're also expecting that same generation to be paying off a load of student debt we've never asked anybody to start their working lives with before.
Yeah, which is why I think, you know, this is a cause that they could really rally behind.
Yeah, exactly. I think I can understand why if your college, your parents, and employers all told you, yeah, take on all this debt, you'll pay it off. And yeah, take these unpaid internships because they'll all pay off for you. And then you start plugging up, you know, you believe them, right? Why would you think they're out to destroy your future? And then you start doing it for several years and realizing you're in a trap and you can't get out of it.
I think the other thing that's really, you know, when you say trap, I mean, the time length of some of these internships are just incorrigible.
Oh, yeah. And it becomes serial.
Yeah.
Right? Because if I'm the employer who's got somebody who's done 3 unpaid internships and I can get – that's 3 positions where they gain some experience I would like to see in the next person I have working for me.
Yeah,
and no prior employer has felt obliged to start paying them yet, I might say, you know what? What about doing your 4th with us?
Yeah. I mean, you see it all the time. You know, and it got me to even say it on the podcast when we were talking about it. I said, you know what? Because I'm a television producer. I said, when I'm in a position, I will pay my interns.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So I'd worked in independent film and mostly documentary film before the Black Swan thing came on my radar. And I remember very vividly working with 2 producers in particular who were really insistent upon paying everybody. And they know that a lot of producers weren't. And they just, you know, for them, it was just a point of principle. And that was something that was then in the back of my mind.
Yeah. But it should be, you know, and that's the thing. I like that. But at the same time, you know, I don't want it to be that way where it's like, oh, these guys are heroes and they're principled for doing what is
right.
By law required.
Well, because it creates unfair advantage to the people that you know are breaking the law.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it creates this opportunity. And then, for example, let's say in reality TV where they'll shop around the production to any of a number of different independent production companies, right? Yeah. And the network is going to, of course, approve the budget when they shop it around. And if one production company is willing to use 5 or 10 unpaid interns to help them make the show – and another production company isn't willing to do that and comes in with a higher budget, who's the network going to choose?
Yeah. No, I listen. I'm working in reality TV. It's very tricky.
Yeah. And to me, it's all those like cutout companies that, you know, make it so hard. I was afraid to pin on the proper employer. I was really glad to find out that the law didn't leave that cutout.
Yeah, yeah. And how have people – you're in law school now. How have people in law school reacted to this whole thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. For a lot of my classmates at first who maybe grew up where this was – or came of age where this was a norm, it seemed a little puzzling at first. I've had many people tell me when I first heard about your lawsuit, I didn't quite get it. But now that they've thought about it further and it's been covered further, and they've started encountering their own unpaid internship work experiences where they've had to actually ask themselves, why am I not getting paid for this?
Yeah.
There is more personal support. I still think it's really hard to find people who want to speak up publicly as well.
Well, I mean, you know, there's that fear of blacklisting.
Oh, absolutely. And here I'm in Washington, D.C., and the federal government unpaid internship scam is widespread. I mean, it is absolutely throughout. It's pervasive. But the thing is, when I read the Fair Labor Standards Act, I read in the act itself that all people who work for the government of the United States shall be considered employees.
Mm-hmm.
The way I read it is the federal government unpaid internship programs need to follow the exact same 6-point trainee test that a for-profit employer would have to meet, and I don't see that they do.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a hard one too.
And it's like, yeah, who do you want? Who's going to come forward and sue the federal government and potentially, you know, because no one's taking jobs at the Department of Justice or at Labor or, you know, wherever they're taking them so that they can sue. They're there to make good connections
right. Well, that's
and
the
get a great
thing.
Job
I,
later.
I think that's the other thing. There's probably some people who probably think, you know, you're doing this, you know, for the lawsuit, but obviously you want to work in entertainment. I mean, or did anyway at some point.
I did, yeah.
Do you now feel like you don't want to work in entertainment, or is this going to impede, you know, the ability to work in entertainment?
Yeah, I kind of figured that was a burned bridge.
Yeah.
I was a later in life career transitioner. That's sort of how this came, on my radar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was really young, I loved the film industry, would have loved to have gotten a job in film. Went a different route. Later in life, decided I was going to, you know, throw my hat in the ring. Unpaid internships are the way you get your foot in the door. That's sort of standard practice. But when I realized, you know, I had more than simply the unpaid internship problem that was making it a little bit more difficult for me to transition in. You know, part of it was, you know, who hires entry-level workers tend to be younger.
Yep.
So I think a lot of people looked at my resume kind of skeptically anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I just decided the reason I was even trying to break into film was to work on social justice issue-focused documentary films that would make a difference.
Right.
And after a certain point in time, I realized it's so hard to break into this industry anyway, let alone to be doing issue-related docs.
Yeah, yeah, it's not a big moneymaker.
And, you know, and I'm running out of time in my working life. You know, I had a few people pass away that were close to me, and I had to do a gut check and say, listen, I've only got so much time left, you know, what, 20, 30 years of my working life? I want to make a difference, and if it's not going to be doing social issue-related documentaries, if I go to law school, I can have more direct impact that way than in the film industry. So, yeah, I don't see myself going back into that in a major way. But if there's a way to get involved with projects and things that relate to the law, I'll certainly do that. I've started a film group here at Georgetown Law School related to that.
You're kind of the Kurt Flood of entertainment.
Well, we'll see.
I mean, I hope not for you, but, you know, if so, it's a worthy cause, and Comedians at Law stands behind you.
And, oh, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and if there's anything you want to promote right now, we usually give you the floor.
Oh, well, you know, I'm really looking to elevate this conversation to, you know, law school reform. There's a lot of talk right now about, you know, even President Obama has said law school doesn't need to be 3 years. It should be 2 years plus some experience. And I think law schools, that, you know, there's a lot of experiential learning opportunities. I don't think they meet the strictest standard. I would love to see more people start voicing concern and getting involved with the discussion about how does student labor in law school affect social justice and the delivering of legal services to people who can't afford it without destroying that very labor market?
It's a very interesting question. Because
to me, this is the thing, right? New York State now requires 50 hours of pro bono lawyering for students before they can enter the bar. There's this suggestion that somehow volunteering is going to meet society's need for legal services for indigent people.
You know, it's so funny you say that. I'm actually working on a script about that very topic right now.
Yeah.
We'll have to talk offline about it.
I appreciate that you're focusing on the issue.
Yeah, I'm tired of seeing the status quo and everybody saying, well, what can you do?
Right.
It's exciting to me to talk to somebody who said, well, there is something you can do.
Yeah, I was thrilled to find out there was something I could do.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate it, and we're very happy to have you. It was a very enlightening talk, and good luck with everything.
Oh, yeah. If anyone out there who is following, feel free to follow me on Twitter or on Facebook.
Yeah, what is your Twitter handle? Why don't you tell them?
Oh, it's at Eric Glatt, and it's the name of the account is Interns Don't Equal Free Labor.
There we go. I like that. All right, well, thank you, Eric.
All right, thank you.
All right, take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.